Good evening and welcome to today's talk of the Center for Cultural Inquiry, and Happy New Year to all of you. It is my great pleasure to welcome and to introduce Mark Fleischmann, who was a fellow of the research group Traveling Forms here in Konstanz last autumn, and who joins us today from the summer of Cape Town for his talk. Mark Fleischmann is professor of theater in the Center for Theater, Dance and Performance Studies at the University of Cape Town. He is also the co-founder and co-artistic director of the renowned theater group Magnet Theater, whose productions have been shown nationally and internationally over the past 33 years. Mark is also involved in development projects in urban townships and rural communities, using theater as a tool for social justice and transformation. His articles have appeared in the South African Theatre Journal, Contemporary Theatre Review, and Theatre Research International, as well as in numerous edited collections. He is the editor of Performing Migrancy and Mobility in Africa, Cape of Flows, and two special issues of the South African Theatre Journal on Translation and Performance that emerged from a multi-year collaboration with colleagues in the Netherlands and in India. Mark is a member of the Executive Committee of the International Federation of Theatre Research, and currently he is the principal investigator of the project Reimagining Tragedy from Africa and the Global South, which is funded by the Mellon Foundation. His talk today is part of this project, which brings together theatrical exploration and academic research. Please welcome Professor Mark Fleischmann for his talk on What is a Classic? 3. Poetry, Myth, and Classical Forms in Some Contemporary South African Theatre. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you very much. I hope the internet is being kind at the moment, because during your introduction, it got a little bit broken. Can you hear me?
Yes, very well.
Okay. So just indicate I can try my best to maybe swap to another router if things start breaking up too much. So once again, thank you very much for the invitation. I was very grateful to have spent 8 weeks in Konstanz, met some of you then, and delivered a paper at the Traveling Tragedies Conference. And this paper today, to some extent, follows on from that. And some of the points that I will make are to some extent slightly repetitive of some of the contextual elements that were brought up in that paper. But you don't have to have heard the first paper necessarily to understand this, what I'm trying to say here, hopefully. So my intention in this presentation is to examine the ways in which what might be called classics are used or continue to be used by contemporary theatre makers in the South African context in the aftermath of formal colonialism and apartheid. I will do this through an examination of specific works by directors who work under the broad umbrella of Magnet Theatre, the independent South African theatre company that I established with Jenny Resnick in 1987, and which we now run together with Mandla Mbotwe. The questions I hope to engage are: what is the status of the so-called European classic in the colonial aftermath? How do these classics function as formal devices in the dramaturgy of contemporary theater in South Africa? And then, are there African classics that either counter or are in conversation with the European classic in the aftermath? And if so, who might lay claim to these different kinds of or classes of classic, and in what ways? Is a classic. This presentation is another in a series of lectures on the theme, What is a Classic?, by artist theoreticians who were born outside of Europe, but to some extent lay claim to a tradition of European classics in relation to their identity and their work. The first of these is T.S. Eliot, who presented his lecture on the topic to the Virgil Society in London in October 1944. The second is J.M. Coetzee, who presented his lecture in the early 1990s at Michigan State University, but was at the time living in South Africa where he was born. He now lives in Australia. And now there is me in 2022, a theater maker who is also an academic, born in Africa, still living and working in South Africa, but perhaps only provisionally or partially African, and indebted to a tradition of European classics that I do not necessarily or always want or own, but which difficult histories and complex presence make it impossible to disown entirely. The line of descent I'm tracing here with regard to this question has a precursor in an essay by Charles Augustin Sainte-Beuve in his Causerie of 24th of October, 1850, later revived as an inaugural lecture at the Collège de France in 1857. Sainte-Beuve begins by providing what he terms a usual definition, an old author canonized by admiration and an authority in his particular style. He goes on to define this further as something that has continuance and consistence and which produces unity and tradition, fashions and transmits itself and endures. He traces the development of the classic idea from the Romans, for whom the classical authors were invariably Greek, through Italy to Spain and then France. Dictionary definitions through the 19th century, he notes, tend to include the expressions models, fixed rules for composition and style, strict rules of art to which men must conform. But he suggests that it might be time to renounce these restrictive definitions and free our mind of them. He then proceeds to provide us with his own definition, and I quote, "A true classic is an author who has enriched the human mind, increased its treasure, and caused it to advance a step, who has spoken to all in his own peculiar style, a style which is found to be also that of the whole world, a style new without neologism, new and old, easily contemporary with all time," end quote. While Sainte-Beuve indicates an awareness that other traditions of literature exist outside of the European nations with their own classics, particularly Indian and Persian literatures, he quickly leaves this idea of a kind of global itinerancy through various literary traditions behind in favor of a more sedentary image. He says, "Nothing blunts and destroys taste so much as endless journeyings. The poetic spirit is not the wandering Jew," end quote. As Antoine Compagnon describes it, and I quote, "The wandering Jew, cosmopolitan, comparatist, the emblematic modern European, sentenced to walk eternally, is the one who cannot choose, settle, sit." Sainte-Beuve, with all due respect to the Orient and the rest of Europe, insists that we must find a dwelling. The classics seem to lead unfailingly to national literatures, end quote. In contrast, in his lecture, Eliot's focus is not national, but imperial and civilizational. He is intent on claiming Virgil as the prototypical classical author who becomes the font of a capacious European tradition. He represents central European values of which England must be a part. Although he references Sainte-Beuve early in the lecture, he claims not to have been able to reread it in preparation for the address. For Eliot, and I quote, "If there is one word on which we can fix which will suggest the maximum of what I mean by the term a classic, it is the word maturity. A classic can only occur when a civilization is mature, when a language and a literature are mature, and it must be the work of a mature mind," end quote. He acknowledges that a definition of maturity is almost impossible, but nonetheless, he goes on to suggest rather vaguely that if we are properly mature, as well as educated persons, we can recognize maturity in a civilization and in a literature as we do in other human beings whom we encounter. If we are mature, we either recognize maturity immediately or come to know it on more intimate acquaintance. Eliot's lecture is full of distinctions. He seems at pains to distinguish between the mature and the immature, between the polite and the provincial, between civilized manners, civilized consciousness and conscience, and the ruffian or plebeian, between the purely local or tribal codes of manners and the Roman and European. And the subject of his lecture, Virgil, is on the plane of manners, not provincial. This seems to be a factor of great importance to Eliot, the poet from the provinces who refuses provincialism. He distinguishes between the universal classic, of which Virgil is his preeminent example, and the classic, which is only such in relation to the other literature in its own language. He calls these the absolute and relative classic. This turns on the characteristics of comprehensiveness and then universality. By comprehensiveness, he means that the classic must, within its formal limitations, express the maximum possible of the whole range of feeling which represents the character of the people who speak that language. By universality, he intends the condition in which a work of literature has beyond the comprehensiveness in relation to its own language an equal significance in relation to a number of foreign languages. And with regard to the latter, it is the so-called dead languages, Latin and Greek, that provide our inheritance. All the peoples of Europe are their beneficiaries. In this vision, England and the English are part of Europe, and Europe derives in direct line of descent from Rome, and Virgil is at the center of European civilization with a unique destiny in relation to ourselves. Our classic, the classic of all Europe, is Virgil. As Anki Mukherjee points out, for Eliot, Virgil is an Adventist Christian, and Aeneas is the prototype of a Christian hero, synthesizing pagan values with those of the Western Christian Imperium to come. It is Eliot's argument that Europe is a whole and the organism out of which any greater world harmony must develop. Virgil sets the standard, which is the price of our freedom, the defense of freedom against chaos. J.M. Coetzee argues that it is important to note a number of key points related to Eliot's lecture. First, it took place in the middle of the war as German rockets were falling on London. And second, that by the time he gave the lecture, Eliot had become an increasingly authoritative public figure as a poet, dramatist, critic, publisher, and cultural commentator who could be said to dominate English letters. He had, according to Coetzee, targeted London as the metropolis of the English-speaking world, and with ruthless singleness of purpose, made himself into the deliberately magisterial voice of the metropolis. Coetzee argues further that in the lecture, Eliot comes to the question from an odd angle. It is odd, firstly, because in the lecture, Eliot ignores or perhaps hides his American origins in his quest to become English, partly as a result of his Anglophilia, partly in solidarity with the English middle-class intelligentsia, partly as a protective disguise against a certain shame about American barbarousness. It is odd, secondly, because his claim that Virgil should be understood as European and his assertion of England's European identity has never really been enthusiastically embraced by the English. Coetzee suggests what he calls an unsympathetic reading of Eliot's lecture, and I quote, an attempt to give a certain historical backing to a radically conservative political program for Europe, a program opened up by the imminent end of hostility and the prospect of reconstruction. Broadly stated, this would be a program for Europe of nation states, in which every effort would be made to keep people on the land, in which national cultures would be encouraged and an overall Christian character maintained, a Europe, in fact, in which the Catholic Church would be the principal supranational organization, end quote. And the definition of nationality Eliot employs aims to redefine and resituate nationality in such a way that Eliot cannot be sidelined as an eager American cultural arriviste by claiming an inclusive conception for Western European Christendom, the world's major culture, which includes its provinces. For Coetzee, Eliot's project to become English and then to redefine Englishness as European and descended from Rome stems from a not uncommon sense of self among colonials, particularly young colonials struggling to match their inherited culture to their daily experience. For such young colonials in Eliot's provinces, the high culture of the metropolis provides extraordinarily powerful experiences, which cannot, however, be embedded in their lives in any obvious way, and which seem therefore to have their existence in some transcendent realm. Coetzee then shifts to his own experience to dig into this condition. He describes a moment in 1955 in Cape Town when he was 15 years old and heard Bach for the first time wafting over the garden wall from the house next door. He describes this moment as a moment of revelation in which for the first time he was undergoing the impact of the classic. Was this, he asks, a revelation of an ideal form across the ages, across the seas? Or was it simply electing high European culture and command of the codes of that culture as a route out of a particular class position in white South African society and ultimately the perceived dead end of that society itself? He believes it is the former, he says, while hoping it's not the latter. For Coetzee, Bach is a classic in two senses. First, the classic is that which is not time-bound, which retains meaning for succeeding generations. Second, Bach's music belongs to what are loosely called the classics, that part of European musical canon which is still widely played. Coetzee acknowledges that the so-called timelessness of Bach's music is in fact the result of an historical process constituted by specific historical forces, a story of loss as a result of rejection and neglect over time, followed by a revival as a result of the efforts of Felix Mendelssohn in the 19th century, and Bach's reclamation as a heroic representative of German nationalism rising in reaction to Napoleon. But he is also at pains to suggest that, in fact, Bach's music never disappeared from view, but was sustained through professional practice networks, which were not necessarily public, but continued to test the quality of the music. And it is this testing that attributed a classical status to Bach. It is the testing process that he has been through within the profession that ensures Bach as classic. In other words, if a work survives the rigorous ongoing process of day-by-day critical testing, it becomes a classic. And this is ultimately Coetzee's main argument. It's not some essentialist quality derived from a nation, culture, or civilization that defines the classic, as argued by his predecessors, Sainte-Beuve and Eliot, but the intense and skeptical testing function of professional criticism against which the classic must survive. This move by Coetzee interestingly takes place precisely at the point of South Africa's emergence from its colonial apartheid condition, which was also, as Mukherjee points out, the moment of Coetzee's increasing alienation from the South African public sphere, its institutional and academic politics, notably the debates and disputations on the shaping of a new national culture. In other words, it seems that even though he rejects or distances himself from the imperial claims and constructions of Eliot, he does not do this in favor of a new sense of belonging in the place of his birth, but rather in favor of a transnational, supposedly cosmopolitan community of professional critics, writers, and readers, which seems, and this is the point of my argument here, to coalesce around the idea of form. Coetzee suggests that what Bach gave him was the idea of form. And supposedly what critics test is the veracity and durability of this form and the capacity it has to maintain its impact and force over time and across space, which in turn produces the classic. What is of interest to me from the above is the way in which Eliot and Coetzee, in their own specific ways, conditioned by the particularities of their contexts, relate to the mainstream literature of their time from outside of that mainstream. As Anki Mukherjee puts it, how they position and imagine themselves is often as out of place, emergent, or coming after, and as needing to rewrite perduring pasts, real and invented. In the end, the question and concept of the classic is perhaps always that of the outsider, end quote. Part two, snapped. This brings me to my own experience, the next in the line of succession to carry what Gayatri Spivak calls the burden of a relationship to the European classic from out of time and place. Eliot rejects the colonial condition in favor of an accession to the metropolitan and the imperial, and Coetzee rejects it in favor of the professional and specialist, although in his choice of example to explicate the idea of the classic, he chooses Bach over the blander American popular music on the radio at the time, Bach over bebop and the Boston Pops, which might suggest more of an affinity to a European high art than he would like to own up to. My own experience, on the other hand, is informed by the time of the decolonial. As I have indicated previously, I understand this time, on the one hand, following Mahmoud Mamdani, as characterized by a delinking of the political subjectivities of native and settler in South Africa, and its replacement with a single category, which he calls survivors, membership of which is determined by citizenship based on location or residency and not on identity. In this way, it produces the conditions for a new post-conflict reality, no longer one in which the dominant question is how to achieve liberation, but one in which the dominant question is how to live together, how to build a particular version of freedom together, whether the individual participants like it or not. On the other hand, I understand the time of the decolonial as the time, place of the gap, the broken context between the state of colonialism and apartheid, and any attempt to provide a significant and sensible response in its aftermath, between the achievement of political liberation and the achievement of a freedom to come. It's not the time, place of the willful subject who performs acts or commits deeds, but of the fragile, vulnerable, and exposed subject who suffers in the face of a traumatic history and in the context of a seemingly endlessly distended present defined by struggle, precarity, violence, invisibility, estrangement, and unbelonging. A question that has arisen in this time is what to do with these classic forms from elsewhere in the aftermath of colonialism. Two contrasting approaches have emerged. Firstly, there is a view commonly and often rather crudely traced back to Ngugi wa Thiong'o that argues for these forms to be banished. In his now canonical Decolonizing the Mind, Ngugi asks, from what base new Africans are to view themselves and their universe, one that continues to be Eurocentric or one that is Afrocentric? And by extension, what materials should they be exposed to and in what order and perspective? This has been used as a basis for the argument that the longer European ideas, forms, and practices continue to be taught and engaged with, Africa will remain subject to neocolonial forces and Africans will continue to exhibit an inherited slave consciousness. This argument suggests that there is an outside to coloniality and that it is somehow possible to reach this outside beyond the contaminations of Eurocentric ideas, forms, and canons by simply turning our backs and heading off in another direction to where the real Africa lies. This seems to me to be the inverse of Coetzee's attempts to escape an engagement with his context by heading off criticism, sometimes called Australia. There is, however, another time, another line of thought that takes the idea of decolonization in a different direction. As Achille Mbembe puts it, and I quote, post-colonial thought is not anti-European. It is, to the contrary, the result of the encounter between Europe and the worlds that were its distant possessions, end quote. In other words, there is no outside to coloniality. We are all, whoever we are and from whichever shore we come, or indeed, wherever we may be located now, the products of and affected by the encounter that can never be completely undone. And Mbembe traces this line back to the thinkers of decolonization in the first half of the last century, and I quote, for Senghor as for Fanon, we are inheritors of the whole world. At the same time, the world, this inheritance has to be created. The world is in the process of being created, and we ourselves are created along with it. Outside this process of creation, co-creation, and self-creation, the world is mute and ungraspable. It is by contributing to this triple process that one gains the right to inherit the whole, the world as a whole, end quote. So what does it mean to be a leftover from a previous time? A leftover in a space scattered with debris, other leftovers, caught between the demand to reject the master's tools, which can apparently never dismantle the master's house on the one hand, and a desire to claim the inheritance of the whole world on the other. Snapped is a play that explores the author's experience of complicated grief following the passing away of her father, a grief that will not pass. Her father, a medical doctor, served in the Second World War in North Africa and then in Italy. It was while in Italy in July of 1944 that he was decorated with a military cross during the battle to capture the monastery at Monte Cassino up the Inferno track above the Inferno River. In the midst of this ferocious battle that took place at night primarily under the cover of darkness to protect the advancing Allied forces from German artillery situated in the monastery above, he repeatedly entered a field full of landmines to attend to and extract wounded soldiers. In describing the event, he would say that he knew that he would not die that day, and therefore was not concerned with the possibility that he might step on a mine and blow himself up. This led to his daughter's later sense that her father was immortal and her inability to accept his demise, even at the age of 88. Her father was also a keen photographer and amateur filmmaker and was the official photographer of his unit. He left behind an extensive archive of photographs that document his experience of the war, including literally thousands of images of grave sites intended for the families of men who died in battle in Europe and never returned to Africa. These photographs and the films he made on various themes after the war are utilized in the production as projections on multiple screens alongside the two performers and against the backdrop of an extensive and evocative soundscape. In the photographs, they often appear alongside white combatants and medics, unnamed black men in uniform, who were part of the auxiliary forces who provided logistical support but were not, owing to the racial politics of the time, allowed to carry weapons. The men in these photographs were mainly stretcher bearers and ambulance drivers. A secondary theme in the play is the representation of the black participants in the war, surfacing their presence in the archive and highlighting their particular stories and struggles. In the play, the moment in which the father, the captain, is raised to the status of hero is also the moment in which his stretcher bearer is killed and buried at the side of the road where he fell and where he remains, trapped in an eternal state of lostness and confusion, desperately wanting to go back home to his family in Africa. The play is divided into three parts. In part one, the author sits alongside her father's grave, represented by a large tree that has fallen at her feet. She has been stuck here for the past 15 years, unable to move on with her life, and she struggles to make sense of this experience by digging into what her father has left behind. A diary from the war, thousands of little sepia photographic images, and a collection of 8mm films on artists like Oscar Kokoschka and Francisco Goya, and on the unfolding political situation in South Africa post-war as the country slid into apartheid. At the end of this section, she remembers a phone call she had with her father 2 weeks before he died, in which she understands herself to have been distracted and neglectful of him. This precipitates a sliding down the telephone wires through the debris of his archive to an unknown, unidentifiable destination. Part two takes place in the hell of war, where she meets her father's stretcher bearer, trapped there for all eternity, and together they set off in search of his captain, her father. In this journey, the stretcher bearer is her guide, and through a mixture of narration, physicalization, and immediate experience, he makes her aware of what happened to her father, and by extension to himself in the battle for Monte Cassino. In part three, the woman appears alone again in a surreal landscape, dressed in a tight-fitting school uniform, riding a child's tricycle. She comes face to face with her child self, hanging upside down from a tree, begging for help to be brought down and turned the right way up, begging for a little kindness from the older woman, who is a copy of her projected image on the various screens. The implication is that the older woman is too concerned with chasing her father to be kind to herself in her moment of loss and experience of grief, and it is only by attending to herself that she will be able to move on. For my purposes here, I will focus on part two because it is the heart of the work, so to speak, and the other parts arise in relation to the central experience of the second part. But also, and more importantly, because part two is constructed with reference to Dante's Inferno, with the stretcher bearer standing in for Virgil and the dramaturgical structure reflecting the descent through various levels of hell to the frozen, frigid space at the center of the world, in which Lucifer slowly flaps his huge white wings, discarding shards of ice each time he flaps. My concern here is with the way in which the Inferno is utilized as a dramaturgical object in the work. I understand dramaturgical object as a kind of Heideggerian ready to hand to complete a particular job of work. It is ready to hand because it is immediately available in the landscape of production, taken for granted as part of a broader system my collaborators and I, white and black, have access to because of the particular context that formed us, despite the geographical locus of production, far from the European source of the work. And in this production, it remains essentially invisible to most, besides the makers and very few in the audience who are able to read or notice the connections to the source text. Kutsiya sees form in Bach as succeeding in its invisibility, the way in which its formal units are withdrawn from view in favor of their incarnation as a coherent higher order object. If the formal units remain visible, conspicuous and obtrusive, to use Heidegger's terms in their English translation, the ready to hand becomes present to hand, which means that they become an object of explicit conscious awareness. In Snapped, I suggest we slide into the experience without an awareness of the job of work the classic insertion is doing ready to hand. Whereas in Antigone, Not Quite Quiet, the subject of my previous talk in Constance, we are constantly forced into an awareness of the presence of the classical work. In other words, it appears to consciousness, present to hand. While the play links to Dante because of its setting in Italy above the Inferno River and on a content level aligns with the experience of the author as she's led to experience what her father encountered in the war, it is its function on a level of form that interests me more. So how does the classical text of the Inferno function as dramaturgical object in the contemporary work Snapped? First, it offers a pre-existing structural blueprint or model that shapes the action. In this sense, the classic work serves as an armature, a pre-existing formal structure on top of which to mold the new work. A tested, stable, and precise structure, which is nonetheless fuzzy enough to allow for some elasticity of application. Second, it provides a linguistic register that is heightened and beyond the everyday, and that sets a tone that is extended beyond speech into a complex physical text that is imagistic and works with and alongside the verbal narrative and the wall-to-wall montage of visual images on the multiple screens to convey and deepen the experience for the performers and the audience. It's my contention that this produces a contemporary version of Dante's Vulgare Illustre, or Illustrious Vulgar, which Frank Kermode suggests is, and I quote, capable in the hands of the provincial poet who understands the metropolitan character of culture, but speaks another tongue, of robustness and severity, splendor and transparency, in short, of imperial civility and vernacular power. Erich Auerbach refers to this as Hochsprache, a vulgar language capable of imperial civility. This is achieved in the production through A, the use of blank verse text, B, the insertion of the local Afrikaans dialect and Italian extracts from Dante in the Tuscan dialect against the predominant English text. C, the inclusion of song as a form of heightened speech. D, the way in which the physical text works with and alongside the verbal narrative and the wall-to-wall montage of visual images on the multiple screens. Third, as a citation in the Benjaminian sense, the production Dante's insertion constellates past and present, there and here, in a manner that disturbs or disrupts simplistic linear conceptions of space and time, difference and sameness. Part three, did we dance? Ukuchona Kamendi. In this final section, I would like to turn our attention to the work of another of Magnet's directors, Mandel Mbotwe. While Mbotwe's background means that he does have a certain degree of access to the kinds of classical texts that we have been concerned with to this point, his most recent work is based on a fragment from the Odyssey, for I would argue that they are far less available to him than they are to me as a director, dramaturg, theater maker. However, I would like to suggest that in two ways, Mbotwe is also engaged in a similar process in which the classic as dramaturgical object is used in the theater making process to achieve specific goals. I will explore this in relation to Did We Dance with Ukuchona Kamendi, but the points I'm making are in fact applicable to his entire repertoire. The play is based on an actual historical event that occurred in February of 1917 during the First World War. 802 members of the South African Native Labour Corps were on board of the troop ship, the SS Mendi, transporting them from Plymouth in England to Le Havre in France, when it sank in the English Channel off the Isle of Wight after being struck by another ship, the SS Darrow. As most of the men could not swim and the number of lifeboats and life jackets was inadequate, and as the temperature of the water was extremely cold, 618 of the 802 African soldiers were drowned, together with 9 white officers and 33 members of the crew. In the inquiry that followed it emerged that the captain of the Darrow had done nothing to rescue those who had ended up in the sea, and that a large contingent of the soldiers who were either too frightened to jump into the sea or were stopped from doing so by the agonized cries of their comrades already in the icy water had remained on board while the ship sank. One of the most enduring and powerful images that emerged from this catastrophe was a report by Reverend Washope Dioba, who had accompanied the men from South Africa. He stood on the deck as the ship went down and comforted the men with the following words, which form part of the text of the production. "Be quiet and calm, my countrymen, for what is taking place is exactly what you came to do. You are going to die, but that is what you came to do. Brothers, we are drilling the death drill. I, Akosa, say you are my brothers, Swazis, Pondos, Basutus. We die like brothers. We are the sons of Africa. Raise your war cries, brothers, for though they made us leave our assegais in the kraal, our voices are left with our bodies." After these words, the men apparently took off their boots and began to dance as the ship slipped into the dark waters. In the production, a non-linear narrative jumps back and forth in time so that past, present, and in some respects future are woven together in a rich tapestry of coexistence rather than being neatly parceled out along a chronological and sequential timeline. While this might prove unsettling and disorientating at times for the audience, it counters the dominance of the present over the past, or to put it another way, it emphasizes the presence of the past as an active force in the present time rather than something that has passed. The text seems to be derived from a combination of academic historical sources and literary sources, particularly the Xhosa poem Ukutshona Kukamendi by S.E.K. Mqai. The latter is slowly inserted bit by bit over the course of the production into the textual and sonic fabric of the work by an old man who seems to be a spiritual healer and who occupies a peripheral position on the edges of the main narrative line and the performance space, very seldom drawing attention to himself or becoming actively involved in the unfolding story. His words seem to fight the rapidly unfolding narrative, a fugitive, anguished counterpoint, struggling to become or be present, but finally finding its focused place and attention right at the end when the old man speaks the final stanzas without interruption. There are two main formal features at the heart of Mbotwe's work that I would like to highlight here. The first is its focus on the choral. By choral here, I mean two things. First, that the central character, so to speak, of the works is collective rather than individual. And second, that the text is not dialogical, distributed between individual characters in dialogue with each other, but comes across as an extended verse performance, sometimes spoken and sometimes sung, that has been distributed amongst various voices that make up the collective. The second formal feature is the use of the isiXhosa language in a form that is not everyday, but heightened and idiomatic in character. It's my contention that these two formal features are the result of the foundational influence of two forms of Southern African oral performance, the Imibongo oral poetic form and the Insomi oral story form of mythic variety on Mbotwe's dramaturgy. These forms are part of what Ngugi calls orature, works of imagination produced by word of mouth, requiring no mediation by the written sign. It is a term that he chooses in preference to oral literature used by authors such as Ruth Finnegan and Isidore Okpewo before him, who were intent on emphasizing the literary value of the oral forms. The term orature, The term orature was first used by the Ugandan linguist Pio Zerumu, for whom it named the use of utterance as an aesthetic means of expression. According to Ngugi, orature is not a branch of literature, but a total aesthetic system with performance as opposed to writing and integration of multiple artistic forms as two of its defining qualities. The Imibongo are traditionally a type of poetry that, according to Lupenga Mpande, are comprised of a cumulative series of praises and epithets bestowed on individuals by their associates from childhood onwards, interspersed with narrative passages or comments. These praises, composed and recited by professional bards, often embody concise allusions to historical incidents and memorable achievements or characteristics connected with each family and may amount to verses of considerable length and excellence. The form of the poetry itself is distinguished from everyday speech by linguistic features of alliteration, rhyme, symmetry, parallelism, harmony, repetition, simile and comparison, and idiomatic and symbolic language. It features common characteristics of Southern Bantu languages such as clicks and laterals, which demonstrate verbal dexterity and produce a specific melody in the poetry. Overall, these linguistic features combined with fluctuations in tone and cadence produce a rhythm to the poem that heightens the emotional response for the audience. As the poet and novelist Mazisi Kunene comments, and I quote, "The poet does not just recite his poetry, but acts it, uses variations of pitch, and aims at communicating his poem through the simulation of all the senses. He produces at one level a symphonic chant, at another a drama, and at still another a dance," end quote. In adopting poetic language of this kind for his productions, Mbotwe follows in the footsteps of an earlier generation of African dramatists, such as Herbert Dlomo in the 1930s. For Dlomo, the language of modern African drama should be poetic, but this should be a poetry not based in rhyme, but on rhythm. In Dlomo's opinion, and I quote, "The dramatist deals with actions, passions, and furies that burst through the stagnant dam-like banks of rhyme and can only be contained in the wider and less defined sea basin of blank and parallel verse," end quote. He finds these forms most suitable because they, he says, already exist in Bantu tribal literature, strong rhythm, repetition, simple and natural imagery. If we adopt this poetic form in our drama, we would be developing and building on what we already have and not taking something totally alien to our culture. Furthermore, in the traditional poetry, rhythm plays a far more important part than rhyme, because in Dlomo's view, African culture emphasizes what he calls the rigid rule of pattern. I quote, "There were rigid patterns of behavior, rigid patterns even in architecture, the hut, and in village or kraal planning." This love of pattern certainly had grave disadvantages, but it gave birth to a marked sense and love of rhythm. Rhythm is more than a physical sensation. It is inspired uniformity in motion, giving birth to thought and emotion and vision. This reference to pattern leads us to the second formal influence, that of the insomi or oral story form. According to Harold Schaub, who has conducted long-term in-depth studies of the Southern African storytelling traditions, the single most important characteristic of African oral performances is the patterning of images. Patterning is Schaub's word for the non-temporal ordering of images that creates rhythm and that subverts the linear surface of the story. The formal result of such patterning is what constitutes the content and the meaning of the story in the African tradition, more than simple linear narrative plotting in a temporal sequence. The patterning of images in turn evokes emotions, which alongside the images constitutes the second important element of story. For Schaub, story is nothing if it does not contain and channel emotion. He explains, "There may be messages along the way, but the ultimate message of storytelling is the complex of emotions, diverse emotions evoked. And these are worked into form by the rhythmical patterning action. And the ordering and shaping of all these emotions evoked within the teller and beyond the teller in the individual members of the audience and in the collective responses of those members engenders a sense of community amongst all who share in the performance event. In other words, there is no meaning disconnected from the performance itself in relation to its audience." Now, according to Ngugi, if the critical faculty helped establish an order of ideas, orature established an order of images. And writers are able to draw on the great deposit of images in orature and the world of oral imagination, often inherited from the past. There are two types of images at play in the Southern African oral stories, fantasy images and images of the real contemporary world. The fantasy images belong to a parallel world alongside the one we inhabit, a parallel world that echoes in prismatic ways our world. But this parallel world is never disconnected from our world. The two worlds are always intertwined, folded into each other. In this way, the fantasy frequently subverts the real and always provides the real with new dimensions and layers of experience and meaning. The traditional storytellers, according to Schaub, typically take ancient emotion-evocative images and build contemporary stories around them. That is, they take images from the world that we know and build them around the venerable images. This is exactly what happens in Mbotwe's work, I would suggest, and in this way, something from the past becomes the catalyst for possible change in the present. However, For Schaub, in the traditional story, I quote, fantasy takes us to the boundaries of our experience. Out there, we are not so sure. Then fantasy moves us back to the familiar, but with a significant change. The familiar can never be the same. It has been leavened, given new dimension by an experience in fantasy, end quote. In this way, the fantasy images generate strong emotions. These emotions arise in part, at least from a sense of existential peril attached to the migration, the crossing over from a familiar space, our world, into a strange, uncontained and unfamiliar space, the fantasy world. But in Mbotwe's work, the element of return is not so simple. Characters remain stuck in the state of peril, of strangeness and unfamiliarity, which connects to my understanding of decolonial time as diastasis. I believe that these forms provide Mbotwe with a foundational model to emulate that functions in a similar way to which the European classic work functions for me in my productions. This model is immediately identifiable to audiences in the context in which he works, despite it coming from a long time ago. But importantly, it also allows for endless accommodation into a contemporary mode while retaining its fundamental character or identity. As Kermode argues, classics possess intrinsic qualities that endure, but possess also an openness to accommodation, which keeps them alive under endless varying dispositions. The question that this gives rise to is whether an oral traditional form can be considered a classic. There is a conception that oral forms fall within what can be termed tradition and belong collectively to a community, whereas classical forms belong to the individual author and are the work of an individual genius. Furthermore, the classical author produces the classical work in writing, the product of thorough refinement and revision, and not in the form of oral composition produced extempore in the moment of performance. The problem with this distinction is that it discounts the possibility that the oral performer of stories or poems, despite basing their performance on an existing traditional repertoire of core images and scenarios, displays the same kind of skill and discernment in the composition of oral performances that an author does in writing. Studies such as those on the master storyteller Nonganile Masitatu Zenani belie this fallacy, which is part of a conception outlined by Frantz Fanon, that the native is ontologically incapable of change and therefore of creation, trapped in an endless cycle of repetition of the same. But I would argue such distinctions also form part of a general dismissal of African literary production within the colonial conception as supposedly provincial, immature, and formulaically repetitive by critics in the metropole like Eliot, who know because they themselves are mature. In addition to the above, as I have already indicated, Mbotwe inserts the written poetry of the Xhosa poet S.E.K. Mqayi into his performance text. And I would suggest this functions as a ready-to-hand dramaturgical object too. But instead of turning to European classic, he turns to what might be called a modern classic of Xhosa literature. Mqayi wrote his poetry at the beginning of the 20th century and was one of the first generation of literary producers in the isiXhosa language. However, what is significant here is that he was also an accomplished oral poet who then took to writing and is therefore a transitional figure between the modes of orality and literacy. His writing therefore includes many of the stylistic and formal features of the oral poetic form. This indicates the difficulty with making hard distinctions between the two modes. But in making this argument, it is important to recognize, along with Suleiman Bashir Jan, that the transition to writing does not constitute the enfeebled life of an oral performance, but an other life, one that has its own proper vitality, which opens the text to new adventures. How does this insertion function for Mbotwe as he embarks on his new adventures? First, it operates in a similar way to my insertion of Dante to produce a form of heightened textuality in performance, again alongside heightened forms such as song and physical expression. Second, and in contradistinction to my ambivalent relationship to the European classic, it seems like Mbotwe is enthusiastically reclaiming the poetry of Mqayi from its relative silencing under apartheid, so that it can serve as a precursor to his own work, a foundational base for his own poetic expressions, linguistically and stylistically, something to emulate, but also for his own sense of artistic self and signature, as it were. In this way, it provides his own work with a genealogy in the isiXhosa language. It shows the Isixhosa language is capable of complex artistic expression, not merely base communication, and marks his work as not European at source. Third, it telescopes the old and the new, the past and the now, which allows for a sense of continuity that counters the idea of a fundamental break between tradition and modernity, or their incommensurability as a result of the colonial incursion. It shows how the African oral forms, which as Mpande indicates have been practiced for at least 400 years, and their new adventures in writing continue to impact on or have import for the present time. In this regard, by the 1920s, Mqhayi himself was using the praise poetry form to comment on contemporary issues like the racial segregation of education. And as Nkandilius Saule comments, even today, Mqhayi's images have a striking relevance. The images impress with their resilience pertaining not only to the African people, but to all the races of this country. Those of you who were present at my previous talk will remember that I also inserted a poem of Mqhayi's into the Tiresias section of my Antigone Not Quite Quiet. But in my case, the insertion is much more ambivalent and can only be a blunt instrument serving to displace the European classic from the landscape of the colonial aftermath. For Mbotwe, it is a much more incisive, nuanced, and complex insertion because it is his language in an earlier and elevated form. As Saule suggests, Mqhayi sought to demonstrate to the world as well as to literary critics that Xhosa literature as a hybrid of oral tradition could be as universal as any other literature. In my view, he does for the African oral tradition what Dante does for Virgil. As Kermode puts it, he explains with beautiful accuracy its position in the history of the world and founds for modern literature a modern language as noble as that of the classics, a vulgare illustre. So in conclusion, like Eliot and Coetzee before us, Mbotwe and I continue to contemplate the idea of the classic. But while Eliot and Coetzee were escapees from their provincial origins, we remain locked together, survivors of the catastrophe that was apartheid, rewriting perduring pasts in a time of emergence from our relative positions in the aftermath. In both our works, classical forms are utilized as ready-to-hand dramaturgical objects, but interestingly, both productions also involve, on a content level, the representation of imperial subjects in wars on behalf of empire, in Mbotwe's work in the First World War and in mine in the Second. I find this interesting because it concerns the anxious, ambivalent relationship of the colonial subject with the metropole, a relationship demonstrated by the need, desire, part of the war effort, despite the degradations of colonialism, but which leads ultimately into a kind of entrapment that anticipates the condition of the decolonial to come. But hopefully what has become clear from the above is, as Ray Chow points out, that the captive thing in the trap is not entirely mute. It produces a plane of articulation that does not necessarily coincide with the articulation of the trap setter, but ruptures from within the trap's presumed discursive unity. In other words, the trap speaks back, a speaking that both evades and ensnares the trapper too, perhaps. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark, for this fascinating talk and also for the way in which you visualized these productions for us. It really became alive for me.